Welcome to the X-Men Task Podcast. My name is Willie.
And I'm Sonia.
And Sonia, today we are joined by some monumental guests here. They are writers and producers of the X-Men animated series, Eric and Julia Leewald.
Yes, and we're very, very excited to have you guys on the show, so welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having us. We really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Willie. Thanks, Sonia.
I just want to say, we started this podcast this year. It's been so much fun, and it's just been mind-blowing. Since we first reached out to you guys on Twitter and saw you had this thriving community already, and you've really supported us, and it's really meant the world. And it's been kind of mind-blowing every time we get a little interaction with you guys. So I just want to thank you for that right off the bat.
Yep.
Well, thank you. That's very welcome to hear. You know, Eric and I kind of tease that so much of our lives being writers is kind of, you know, home alone in our home office, you know, looking at each other occasionally. So it's nice to get feedback from somebody out in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's kind of been the amazing thing about it, is that like there is this whole community out there that we didn't know about either. And they've also, you know, been so excited to hear from you guys and been still following, you know, all the events of the X-Men all these years later. So, yeah, we're all not alone. It's great.
Yes. Boy, that's gratifying.
Yeah, I know. It's like it's just so bizarre that, you know, I'm 33 years old right now. I started watching the show when I was 8. So it's just like it just feels like this, you know, the internet was sort of came into being during that time span between me being 8 and 33. And it's nice that the 8-year-old self gets to communicate with you guys, the creators, all these years later, thanks to the magic of technology. So I don't know. I'm just like, I'm tripping out of my mind right now. So just forgive me.
Well, would it help if we just do a little quick intro here, just to kind of explain who and what we were and what we're doing now? I'm Julia Leewald, and I had the privilege of being a writer on several episodes of X-Men, the animated series. Happened to be a fly on the wall for most of the meetings because worked as a writer on the show. But also my husband here, Eric Leewald, was in charge of every single episode on the writing side. His name's on every episode. He developed it for TV from the comic books with the help of some very talented artist people and other folks through Fox Kids and Marvel Studios. And we realized, Eric, correct me if I'm wrong, but that 25 years had passed since X-Men came on TV.
Yes. You guys actually brought that to our attention.
And, you know, there, for various reasons, it wasn't being celebrated the way, say, maybe Star Trek would be celebrated or Batman would be celebrated. It's like, well, heck, yeah, let's just do it ourselves.
Yeah.
So that's...
And that is a total crime, because this show is a masterpiece, in my opinion, anyway.
Bless you.
And, so 25 years. And that sort of, leads into my first question here. We were sort of spying on your IMDb profiles in preparation for this. And we see that both of you have worked in animation, a good portion of your careers. So my question is, how does one end up writing for an animated show? And branched off that, how does it compare to sort of a different, like a regular Hollywood writing gig?
Well, it was kind of dumb luck. Neither one of us grew up here or knew anybody out here. So I came from Tennessee and she came from Texas. And so we're looking around trying to get our foot in the door and see what job comes up. And in my case, it was a neighbor was working for Hanna-Barbera when they suddenly needed extra writers in the mid-80s. So that's where I pitched and got my first professional job out here. Julia was on a softball team with a woman that was on staff at Disney TV Animation. And so it's who you bump into. And I mean, you spend 10 years getting to that point and preparing for that point, but I don't think either one of us planned to get into animation, but we ended up really enjoying it and feeling like it suited us.
We just wanted to write, each of us, and the fact that this has provided us with that kind of opportunity and we've been able to make a career out of it out here has just, it's been still every day amazing to me.
Well, that's how the best careers are born, isn't it? It's usually by accident.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And to answer Willie's question about the difference, it's pretty stark because we, you know, we have friends that work that do sitcoms, and we've done some live action work. Mm-hmm. And what happens is on live action shows, either sitcoms or movies, the director tends to want you to write as little as possible. And heck, in sitcoms, it's just basically dialogue and a little bit of action reaction. Whereas in animation, since somebody has to draw it, you have to kind of make the movie in your head because you want to be able to tell the artist, okay, this is what I want these six characters who are fighting each other to be doing for the next minute, as opposed to just say, the X-Men fight X-Factor for 60 seconds. You don't want to drop that into an artist's lap and have him, you know, have to do 100 drawings on who knows what. So animation scripts are longer because we put in a lot of physical detail, a lot of the character reactions and things. And that, to me, just makes it more fun. It's just, it's like you're more of a filmmaker in your head than if you're, you know, writing for a sitcom in prime time.
By way of example, an average script for X-Men ran
about 40 pages.
And then we worked on Young Hercules for Renaissance Pictures years ago with a very young Ryan Gosling, and that was live action.
And it was 20 pages. It was literally half the length.
Wow. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, that's like a great word choice, too, that it's like making a movie in your head, because we were just talking about that in the last episode that we did. It was the last episode of season one, and we were talking about how cinematic a lot of it is, especially the fight scenes, and there's these great moments of, flying through the air and laser beams and lightning and all this stuff
and dramatic lighting and
right, and we were like really just using that same vocabulary that you used, saying like, wow, it's cinematic, it's like a movie scene, like the attention to detail and the theatrical nature of it is really, we were admiring it basically. So that ties together really well. Thanks for that explanation.
Okay, that's awesome. All right, my next question. Who was the brainchild behind the show, and how close did the team get to sticking with the initial idea of whatever that was?
Eric, it's to handle, but I got to just jump in here and say, it's not often you're going to hear folks who work in the industry sing the praises of executives in the studios, but... unlike probably everything else on the planet, X-Men the Animated Series needs to give all the credit in the world to some folks at what the time was Fox Kids, because that's the reason this show got made. And again, you guys are younger, but you came up on X-Men. Think back in the day when it was ABC, NBC, CBS, and then Fox Kids came on the market as the next fourth network. And was scrapping and fighting and brawling and came into existence in 1988. So for 2-3 years, they were the president of the network, a woman named Margaret Lesh.
The Children's Network.
The Children's Network was campaigning tirelessly to be different, to be strong, to be exciting. And
so to answer your question, it's her doing. It's all her doing. Margaret Lesh tried to get, and this is all in the book, so it's funny.
Oh, that's all right. We're going to get to your book.
Yeah, don't give it all away, I guess.
but she'd been a great independent producer here in Los Angeles, and back in the 80s, all sorts of small companies produced shows, and then every February, they would pitch ideas for shows to the networks, and the three networks would buy one show and not another show. So there were a lot of these smaller companies, and one of the smaller companies was Marvel Productions. And for 5 or 6 years, she produced some really nice shows for them, but she couldn't sell. She loved X-Men
as a property,
as an idea for a TV show, but nobody in Hollywood would buy it. They said, oh, nobody's going to watch that. It'll be some, you know, pimply 19-year-old guys in basement.
Yeah,
kids aren't going to watch it.
Who's going to forget it? Marvel stuff's never worked on TV. Superheroes movies don't really work. You know, Batman had worked, but that was about it. And that was 1989, so that was pretty light.
So anyway,
Margaret pushed, couldn't get it on. Long story short, when she suddenly became the person deciding what goes on on network, this new small network, her first order of business was, this may take me a year or two, but I'm going to assemble a team of people that I like and make and get X-Men on TV. And she had the same idea for Batman, but X-Men was her first love. And she and her assistant, Sidney Eyewander, who was the hands-on guy, those two people made it happen. Everybody else were people they hired or people they wanted, and they were from the way before it started till after it ended. It was their doing that it happened.
So is that how you guys jumped on board? Were you part of that initial team that was assembled, or?
Yeah, I'd worked for Sydney a couple times, once back when we both were getting started at a place called TMS, which a Japanese animation house. And then when he got on at Fox with Margaret, early on, they decided to do a season of Beetlejuice.
Because Beetlejuice had been on ABC.
They got the rights to it. They were going to make it edgier.
And put it on Fox.
Yeah. And so Sydney had me come and do a season of that for him. And Margaret liked it. So I had worked for them for about 9 months on a previous series. And so when they realized that they're going to be able to get the X-Men project off the ground, and it took a lot of doing to get the project together. When they realized that, they looked around and said, okay, we want this guy designing it, this guy directing it, this guy in charge of the writing. And they thanked God. The morning before I found out that I was doing it, they called me in and talked about another show. I didn't know I was going to do it until the night before the meeting that, oh, by the way, Stan Lee's going to be there, and all the production people from Marvel and all of the animators, and everybody's going to be there, and you're going to be be in charge of the writing for X-Men. And I said, well, great, but I've almost, I haven't read the book.
Right.
You know, I'm going to just keep my mouth shut and try to get through the meeting and keep my job.
And I'm jumping in. It's 1992.
Yeah.
There is no internet.
Yeah.
There is no 24-hour comic book store. There is no way in that 12 hours for you to suddenly become well-versed in X-Men.
Yeah, so I called somebody and got a little bit of the lowdown and a couple of super, fanboy geeks that could talk about it for an hour at a time, and I took fast notes. And we just kind of were thrown in the deep end of the pool as far as getting the show started and getting the first season laid out. The head producer, designer, Will Mineo, and the head producer, director, Larry Houston, were both big Marvel fans.
Mm.
And, Will from the time he was a child, both from the time they were children. So, and they each had 10, 15 years in the business. And so I was able to talk to them at length. And as we developed for a season, they were there and the Marvel people were there. So we were able to not make too many mistakes as we learned the X-Men's world as we wrote.
Well, I just have to say, I mean, in light of that information about not knowing that much about the X-Men, it's not easy to research in the early 90s. Like, you guys nailed it. I mean, the tone is just perfect for, for introducing, like, a famous Marvel property like that. I don't know what else to say other than that. It's just, like, it just struck the perfect note. I mean, just the balance of characterizations and... and the way you guys would summarize famous stories and add new elements and sort of balance out other characters, it was just great. So, I mean, maybe it was a good thing that you weren't like X-Men experts or something.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I think Eric was about to make the point that that's that.
Yeah, that's good. We had a balance. There'd be people that were really good storytellers and who just wanted to be able to tell a more adult story and hadn't been able to. And so this was an exciting, exciting opportunity for them.
Yeah.
And
I have to ask you, though, whose idea was it for the tone to be, sort of adult-oriented and sort of – and the show is just so sexy and cool. And you wouldn't think that a kids' network would, go for that kind of style or tone. And, endlessly fascinates me as, a 33-year-old to this day.
Well, and there's going to be – we need to name a third executive here who deserves a tremendous amount of credit at Fox, and that's a woman named Avery Coburn. Mm. And who is she? She had the thankless task of being in charge of broadcast standards and practices for Fox Kids when X-Men and Batman and many other shows are happening. And watching the memos fly back and forth and listening to Eric on the phone trying to defending legitimately various choices, and her willingness to go along with some of these things, to me, is still amazing.
Yeah, she was really thoughtful, and she respected the books, and she liked good storytelling. But it was really kind of this weird perfect storm. You know, Julia and I have each worked on three or four dozen shows over the years, and almost never do you get the right mix of people. And if one or two people, if Avery had been the wrong person, or if the producer-director had been the wrong person, if there's a bad apple in the mix, then it just doesn't come out right. But luckily, the people whose show it was, and that was Fox, they wanted it to be that adult tone. They wanted to get everybody's attention. They wanted to be different.
Well, that's so cool, yeah.
So they took risks. Yeah. They got terrible crap from advertisers and people that didn't understand that they'd look at some footage and they say, well, this is pretty well produced, but you know, we can't sell our toys and cereal to this stuff. This looks like stuff for adults. So until it showed in January and suddenly was the number one show for kids, you had all these people throughout the business that were just beating up this poor woman, Margaret, for pushing the show and risking the show that was so different.
Mm-hmm.
And so all credit to her that she stood by her guns and said, no, kids will love this.
Well,
it's more sophisticated. They will aspire to it.
Yeah, well, there's all these like themes throughout it, like having to do with prejudice and genocide and like intolerance in these different ways that are like, you know, a veil in some ways for like things that are paralleled in the real world, like now as much as then, right? So is it that like these executives said, okay, here's the tone we want to strike, and it's up to you to do that task, or was it really just like inherent in the stories and that's the way it went and it passed because it was great? Like, you know what I mean? Like, which angle did it come from?
The not the funny thing, but the first meeting Eric had was February 92, and they wanted it to be created and put on the air by fall of 92. And that's zero time in terms of making a TV animation.
Yeah, like come up with the first 13 stories in a week kind of thing.
Wow.
And so that there was a lot of pressure there. But as far as who was deciding how sophisticated it was, it was this wonderful luck of you've got all these 30-something writers and artists who are dying to do something for themselves, or they think they can push themselves to do their very best work, and they haven't been allowed to because, oh no, it's for kids, you'll upset the advertisers, the toys won't sell, whatever, you know, all these restrictions over the years. You know, you're earning your salary, you're doing your work here in Hollywood, and they're just telling you, you have to do with blinders on, you have to dumb it down. And so suddenly you've got all these artists and writers that are told, no, go ahead and push it.
Yeah.
And we'd have discussions like that, like the Nightcrawler episode. I looked up Nightcrawler because I really didn't know him very well, and it said, one of the first things it said, he's devout. I said, well, hell, that's what we need to do.
Yeah.
Nobody's done it on kids' TV before, but so I bring it up to the network, who are the ones that are going to be nervous and get the hundreds of angry letters from mothers and preachers and because we got religion wrong.
Right.
And instead of saying, well, you know, we need to tiptoe around this, like, Sydney, Mark's assistant said, push it harder. Wow. In fact, we handed it a fairly tentative premise. You know, we focused on religion and faith and God for that, but we did it kind of in the midst of a bigger adventure story. And the note, you know, we got a phone call back from Sydney, said, no, make it more about the religion. Screw this other stuff. We see stuff another episodes. Go with this.
Yeah.
And so
that's the classic episode, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. There's complete support from the network. There's all the crew people, all the staff that want to push it harder. And the minute, up until the time it became a hit, so for like an 8-month wait there, before the stuff came back and before it had played, there was great resistance and great fights and lots of, people wanting to dumb it down and some folks having to say, well, you'll have to fire me if you want me to dumb it down. All of a sudden, the split second it scored and was a big hit, everybody shut up. And just let us do it for the next 4 years.
Well, that's one of my other questions I had. I was wondering, like, so obviously the ratings came in, but it's this sort of a pre-internet age, so you just have to kind of blindly trust the ratings, because like it's hard to go out and meet a bunch of kids that might be the audience and ask them what they think about it. You know what I mean? Like, I'm sure you guys got a lot of fan letters too, but like, how did the news of it being a hit like hit you guys, and what was that experience like?
In a way, you're absolutely right. There was no sense of immediate feedback, or no sense that at that time,
no web,
you know, and everything that might have been mailed in was going to Fox Kids Network. I did have the moment in a 2 or 3 seasons in, going back, Fox Kids, they were smart. They had a lot of they put a lot of effort into reaching out and setting up the Fox Kids Club.
Right.
Have kids with card carrying Fox Kids members, and so that's where kids would send in their fan actual letters with stamps on them that they wrote.
Which, you know, you can, what's the rule of thumb? Like, you see a kid put a letter in the mail, that you could have 10 or 100 or 1,000 more kids who feel the same way but just haven't mailed a letter.
Right.
And in Fox Kids, in the hallway, they had stacks of those post office boxes, those sort of clear yellow boxes, tilting.
So stacked to the ceiling.
That must have been very satisfying. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience, and every guest member we've had on the show thus far, our minds were blown by this TV show when it came on. And as you guys know, that it came on as a pilot, and we had to wait before the show resumed, and it drove us insane. Because the pilot was so great that, you know, like, that's all anyone at school could talk about was, like, when's X-Men coming back? You know, where is it? What's going to happen?
So, you know, I'll say, it breaks my heart that there's no such thing as appointment TV for kids or for anybody anymore, really. Because back then, I love hearing that, because that is the true gold standard for people. They'll talk about it, especially kids.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a common experience that, like, all our, you know, everyone I've talked to about the show and all our friends have shared with us too since we've been doing the podcast, that just when the pilot hit, it was just a sensation in people's lives, you know, because kids had never seen anything like that before, and it was just almost exactly what everyone from our generation wanted.
That's great. About that preview, and it was on Halloween. It was October of '92. The reason that you guys got a preview and then a second one before it actually premiered full time in January was that it was supposed to start in September, and there were so many there was a kind of under budgeted and under scheduled, and there were lots of teething problems and lots of creative fights. And so when September was rolling around, Margaret realized she only had 1 or 2 episodes. The others were still being animated, and it didn't look right yet, and it didn't sound right yet. And so she made this really amazing decision to, instead of like putting something that was half wrong on the air in September, she held off till January, which cost them hundreds of thousands of dollars, I'm sure, because in advertising stuff. She held off till January, but then she put on a couple finished episodes in October and November as sneak previews.
And she managed to turn lemonade out of those lemons, because she was getting from all sides. The advertisers had insisted that this roll forward, and the affiliates were furious that this new show she promised was not going to be ready.
Yeah, so it was a crisis that created all this cool anticipation. Because people see it in October and say, "What's it coming on? What's coming on?" And you had to wait 6 weeks, which I'm sure when you're a kid is
literally an infinity of time. I still feel like I'm waiting.
Back in '92 and '93, TV was a little more schedule focused, meaning everything kind of rolled out in September. Right. That was like all your new shows and all your returning shows came on with new episodes. And she was able to sort of sell it to the affiliates with the idea, okay, look, Batman's coming out in September. All the other shows on our network are coming out in September. We'll do this in January with X-Men, and everything else will be in reruns at that point. This will be the only brand new episode show that'll be out there for anybody. And that again was one of those things that caught people's eye, that it was a fresh show when everything at that point was in repeats in January. And that made a difference too. So again, a lot of things happening, a lot of moving parts behind the scenes here.
It's a good luck.
Good luck, yeah.
Well, I think kids were primed to watch it whenever it came out. I think that's how good that pilot was. It was just it was perfect. But a question we had was, so when the show came back to you guys, finally animated and with that voice cast we know and love, what was your reaction to, like, seeing it? Because it's one thing to be sitting around in a room and, like, dreaming it up, but then, you know, they present it to you guys. What was your reaction to, like, what you had created, and how did that affect what you were, like, going to do going forward, too?
Yeah, the voice thing is a cool thing. I mean, we have people like Bob Harris, who was our advisor from Marvel, who lived with the characters for 20 years, and who was the X-Men guy at Marvel at the time. And he was up there. By the way, it was all recorded in Canada, up in Toronto.
Right.
And so I wasn't there for the recordings. He was, and the producer was. And he said it was fascinating hearing these voices for the first time. What we were doing down here in Hollywood was, we'd written all the stuff, and we'd written little sample bits for the actors to try out with, to audition with. And we got tapes back from them. This is after we finished all the scripts and we were waiting to see what the voices were going to be like, and they were awful. And it wasn't, I was like, my God, what's going on? Some of these people are even names we know. And what it was they and the guy directing them just didn't realize how different the show was. So it was very the first recordings were very cartoony and over the top and kind of Scooby-Doo-ish. And so
Wow, that's really strange to imagine now.
And thinking, well, the show's over. You know, the show's over, we're done, we're cooked. And so what happened was, a couple of the guys, Sidney Eyewander and Larry Houston, went back up to Canada and got across to them, no, these are mini-movies, these are dramas. We need gravitas, we need theater actors, we need people that take this seriously. And they re-recorded it four or five times, mm-hmm. and just wore the actors out until they got them to where they were right. And we then down here a second set of audio cassettes. Jesus,
that's what they were.
Yeah, the second set with everybody getting the direction right and everybody getting the tone right, and we were just ecstatic. We didn't even need to hear even watch the first episode. We could hear these guys.
Oh my God, yeah.
Being like one page scenes from the pilot, and you know, Wolverine, I go where I want to go, whatever. Yeah. You got people doing it, and this is going to be wonderful. So we went scared to joy, and much credit to Dan Hennessy, who was the voice director up there. But it was again Sidney Eyewater and Larry Houston and Margaret saying, this won't stand. I don't care. Almost any other kids show, they just would have run with it, whatever they got, because they wouldn't have the budget or do it. And they said, no, we're going to redo this and redo this and redo this until it's what it needs to be. And they did that, and they saved it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That was worth it.
Yeah, the voice acting is, like, you know, it's among the best voice acting ever, in my opinion, for an animated show. It's so good. I mean, and all the side characters too. You know, even the voices of the Sentinels, the guy who does Apocalypse. I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah.
And I'll bet that if you happen to just see an image or grab a comic book, you're hearing the voice of Cal Dodd in your head.
Yeah.
Hugh Jackman. I will never argue with Hugh Jackman, but the voice I hear in my head for Wolverine is Cal Dodd.
It's a shame that, like, DC had the foresight to give Kevin Conroy, the guy who did Batman, he almost has like a lifetime contract to do that voice in a lot of different animated things and video games. Cal Dodd needs that deal too. I mean, it's a shame that he doesn't get to reprise that role over and over again.
Yeah, he deserves that deal. I mean, that's and the problem is too is you look at what DC has continued to produce. They've done a lot of wonderful, you know, animated direct-to-DVD movies. Marvel hasn't, you know,
yeah,
sitting there fallow for a long time, and that's sad. That's sad.
It definitely is. All right, let me move to my next question. Can you guys tell me about some of the episodes you wrote or contributed to, and what your favorite moments from those episodes were, or maybe a few favorite lines?
One of the ones that I contributed to, going back to kind of how this whole thing happened, Eric and a very talented writer, one of your best friends here, Mark Edens, would sit around our dining room table banging out the first 13 episodes, you know, and just sort of vamping off each other, trying to come up with what the stories would be. And then, so it was very kind of just two guys sitting in the dining room trying to think of stuff, and, you know, and I would pass through occasionally and toss things out. And then later, when we'd have more formal writers' meetings, it would still be just a bunch of friends kind of sitting around talking back and forth. And I pitched the idea for what became the story Beauty and the Beast, where Dear Beast, you know, finds love. But
oh, that's a great episode.
And a good friend of ours, Stephanie Matheson, got to write that. And that one just resonates because, you know, I'm a romantic, and it's Beast, and it's, you know, and you don't really think that you get to write that kind of stuff for a kid show. But that's one of my favorites in that regard. Just a fan of that one on an emotional level.
Yeah, we're fans of that one too. That's a great episode.
And of Beast as a character in general, yeah. Also, you know. So
yeah, you guys did a great job with Beast.
And one thing that I found out since, you know, so much happened, it goes by so fast, and you don't even realize, but all credit to Larry Houston for planting genius little Easter eggs throughout the whole series run. But so I believe Beauty and the Beast is a season 2 episode.
Yeah,
and then in season 3, there's a quick shot, and I use it a lot on the Twitter feed, but a quick shot of Beast at a computer keyboard. And taped to the keyboard is a picture that just says, "Love, Carly," and it's a drawing of Carly from Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. It's never referenced. It's never called out. It's just, if you're a fan and you watch it, you catch that and you go, it's not over for him. You know, that happened and it's real. And it's like, oh my God.
And just for your Beast sense, you know, this is one of the moments of the book that I think is going to be surprising to fans. When we had that first big meeting in February, everybody weighed in about what the show should be, because it had been like 20 different X-Men up until that point.
Yeah.
Who's going to be on the show? Who's going to be the leads? You know, back and forth and back and forth. Everybody had different opinions. And so when we left the meeting, Mark Evans and I he was almost a, you know, I mean, he was a co-developer of the series for sure, the first two seasons for sure. We're sitting there staring at him, and we were given a group of people that, for the core cast, that did not include Beast, Jean Grey, or Professor Xavier. They were secondary characters.
Oh. Okay.
And so we're sitting there trying to lay out the first 13 episodes, and the more we get into it, the more Mark and I just, A, realize that the leader of the group is the professor. I mean, right. He articulates everything about why they are X-Men, so we got to use him more. Jean Grey seems like an emotional center for the whole team. Everybody relates to her in a way that they don't relate to anybody else. And then as we're writing, we kept on wanting to write for Beast. The reason he's in jail at the beginning, you know, early on, is we were just going to have him for a couple episodes and then not see him for 6 episodes, just because we were told he was going to be a secondary character we saw. And the more we wrote for him, the more we wanted to write for him. And by the time we were done sketching out the first 13, he had grown into this core main character just because the writers wanted him in there, not because we'd been allowed to or told to or anybody, you know, in marketing or had decided Beast would be a cool character. He just emerged. He forced himself. The strength of his character, we had to use him. He was just too cool.
You know, we actually had a question from somebody in the Facebook group, the X-Men Task Facebook group, that he was asking, from a writer's perspective, there were these other X-Men characters that were introduced over time but never actually joined the team. There was Colossus and Nightcrawler, Iceman, that like had maybe one episode focused on them, but for the most part, they're side characters. And he was asking, was it something that you guys, the writers, had considered, like folding them in more, or were there specific reasons for not doing that?
Big big challenge with a cast that's already, what do we
nine.
Have? Yeah, eight X plus Professor X, mm-hmm. you know, got nine.
And just people.
So trying to service each one of the core team is pretty challenging. And then the hopefully the use of folks like, you know, Bobby Drake or Colossus, those were ways to include them in the umbrella of X-Men.
Right.
But it was juggling a lot of balls in the air.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it was, in retrospect, it was great the way you guys handled it. You really struck the balance, and having these other characters as sort of guest stars or, you know, spoiler, you know, Easter egg appearances, that was perfect. But as kids, though, it would, like, you'd see Iceman, and you're like, is Iceman going to be on the show now? I need to see Iceman again.
Right, because it gave this feeling of, like, the core cast, even though it's a lot of cast members already, it gave this feeling of, like, that's the tip of the iceberg
yeah.
in this, like, X-Men universe. Like, who are all these other, like, mysterious, you know, mutants that we might know something about? So it's pretty genius, you know, because it really, like, draws you in.
We like to think that there are a lot of folks who found the Marvel Universe by way of X-Men the Animated Series.
Definitely.
May have been reading the comic books for the previous 30 years or, you know, and I keep saying this, you know, and here we got $1 billion movies coming out, but
it's all from you guys.
The bridge is X-Men the Animated Series.
Oh yeah, definitely.
If it hadn't been for that, I doubt we'd see the kind of movies we're seeing today. And
I mean, that was my next question. I was going to say, because I've emphatically been saying that in the podcast, the success of the series led Fox to greenlight the movies, right?
Absolutely. Margaret had to fight to get the show,
X-Men
the,
made. I mean, animated.
The show here. Even though she was head of kids programming, she had to get an okay from the head of the network, her boss. And the boss looked at the X-Men and said, look, I don't get it. I wouldn't put the show on the air, but you seem to be passionate about it, so I'll let you take the chance. So the TV network didn't get that the show would be successful. Once the show was this huge international hit, she went to the movie people at Fox and said, guys, look, the whole world is watching our show. You need to make a movie from this.
Right.
And it took them a while. I said, well, you know, it's a kid's thing. It's a Saturday morning thing. You know, we're features. We're different. We have different audience. You know, we'll get back to you.
That is, so, okay.
It took her a couple years.
Yeah.
And I guess Marvel making however much money they made off all the merchandising and everything, gradually, finally, the feature people said, okay, well, maybe we'll, you know, develop a script.
Yeah, it just kind of angers me deep down, of just even though they did make the script, obviously, and they went ahead with the movies, just the feet-dragging attitude to begin with, it's just so short-sighted. I mean, that show was every... I mean, I was 16 when the first movie came out, and... You know, and the reason we went to the movie is because of the show. It was such a clear bridge in our minds. It didn't, you know, there was no doubt about it.
And also, if you look at the team they picked, you know, they could have picked any of the X-Men, you know, from the past 35 right. years books. They chose pretty much the Saturday morning crew, you know. And
that was my next question.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because did you guys... Yeah, you guys learned that Brian Singer, he just watched the show as his research for the movie.
Right.
So, yes.
Did that, like, I don't know, like, did you take that as a compliment or feel a little, like, you know, like, you know.
A certain type of way about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Hollywood's kind of weird that way. There's a lot of money involved, and they get nervous, and it's almost like most things fail out here, so people get nervous about covering their asses.
Right.
So if they've got something like a $50 million X-Men movie to make, they don't know. Nobody out here knows if something's going to work or not, if the magic's going to happen or if it's just going to be a dud. And so they tend to try to hire people with great resumes, or at least the appropriate resumes, because imagine if they're put $50 million on the line and an X-Men movie had crashed.
Yeah.
And somebody, they're looking around to blame someone.
Yeah.
They look and see the executive hired some animated TV guy. So there is that weird distinction.
Yep.
He's still using stuff from your show. In the Apocalypse movie, there's, I feel like there's still scenes and themes ripped straight from the television show.
Absolutely. In fact, David Hayter got credit for the first movie or two because there was a lot of rewriting going on. Mm-hmm. Those couple, and we met him and worked with him on a small project, and he confirmed the stuff that was in the press about Bryan Singer, that he and Bryan Singer and everybody else that tried to work on the first movie, they just watched and rewatched. You know, didn't pick up a comic book, and that's. We got a dog here.
That's anyway. Okay. Hi, dog.
So that was complimentary to us because
good.
They respect our work, but at the same time, it's a little frustrating. They asked us. They asked me and the producer director Will Mineo and the producer to give notes on an early X-Men script for the first movie.
Oh wow,
it's pretty terrible. So we were able to weigh in a little bit on it. Something people don't know is that, or they may know, I'm sure it's in the fan verse, Josh Whedon took a shot at the first movie.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful. We went in to look at it to give our reaction to it, as advisors. And I just walked out of the room and it was under guard. I couldn't take it out.
Really?
So I left the room and just looked at whoever was there and said, look, don't change a word. It's perfect. Hmm. It was that that beautifully. They used something kind of in between. I don't know who contributed what because so many people were on that first movie.
Yeah.
But it's a weird feeling. We lived with these characters for 5 years, and then hey, now they're going to make a movie of them, and they don't ask us. And
right.
Get it. From a business standpoint, but it was frustrating from a creative standpoint. We think could have given it a good shot.
Well, you're talking to people that want the show, like that always wanted the show to come back and never end. So,
well, thank you for that.
I honestly, I don't even know. I understand that the rights are really complicated, especially between Marvel and Fox and Disney and everything, and it's like, but imagine if they brought the whole gang back together with the voice actors and you guys just made an animated straight to DVD movie or something. I mean, that would be a massive success. It would just destroy. I think the internet would melt down if something like that were possible. I mean, can you explain to me why that is probably never going to happen?
We wish we could, but we've worked in. Know folks over at an operation out here called Shout Factory that they do wonderful Blu-ray and DVD collections of movies and shows, and they put out one from our work on Young Hercules with young Ryan Gosling, and got us talking, and it's like, boy, wouldn't it be nice if someone did a Blu-ray or a DVD version of the animated series and put some extras on there, an interview here, an explanation there, or at least put them in the right sequence or something.
Yeah. Mm.
Couldn't even get a phone call return.
Yeah, they tried. They were going to do all the work, and we were going to give them all the extras. And I've interviewed 36 people for the book. I would have had all stuff. They could have had a mini book in with the Blu-ray collection, and people would buy it by the hundreds.
I think
by the millions.
Oh my God! Yeah, definitely.
And to hear, but now it's Marvel Disney, and that's a problem. It's Marvel Disney, and Fox has the movie rights, so Disney's not keen on pushing the characters, so they tell Marvel to shut up about it. And it's this mess. Now, upside of the mess was this little garage band of a group of people got thrown together when it was made, and we didn't have, the head of Disney or the head of Warner Brothers, somebody looking over our shoulder and telling us to calm it down. So the fact that it was a bit of a mess being as a production, I think let us be independent and let us make the show we wanted to make.
But you know what, though? I just got to say, the achievement you guys pulled off, it's not just even influencing the X-Men movies. I feel like the show influenced the tone of all the really successful Marvel movies, too. Just the way you guys like had the little spoilers with other characters from the Marvel Universe, you know, just make a quick appearance, the way you would stitch, you know, seasons together and the serialization of it, and the tone between like really serious and, you know, weighty adult issues, but with like
also a lot of humor thrown in.
Bright humor and color and fun. I mean, that is what the tone of these Marvel movies are now. It's all laid out there in the X-Men animated series. If you watch it straight through, it's like the blueprint.
Right. And, well, and drawn from the comic book as well, you know, like really firmly rooted in everything that came before. So it was really like,
yeah, I mean, you guys were the bridge between the comics and like the live action stuff. And, you know, I feel like you guys set the tone for like everything that's like making trillions of dollars today.
Well, thank you for that. That's very gratifying. I'll tell you, when we were as a writer on it, looking around and saying, you know, we're not writing a kid's cartoon. We're writing a live action drama that happens to be animated and happens to be a half hour. You know, that was kind of how we were looking at it, you know, in terms of never writing down to the audience, never writing just for kids, treating it seriously. 'Cause you know, that's also part of the world of working in what is typically called children's animation. Yeah. So many folks get, oh, well, kids aren't going to understand it, or kids aren't going to figure it out, or you're going to confuse them. It's like, holy moly, you have, remember what it was like to be a kid? Because I actually kind of do, you know?
Yeah, we talk about this a lot in the show, how as kids, we loved that it was adult and a little bit over our heads and had all this mystery and it was connect. You know, it's not like we didn't need one-off episodes. We liked that they were tied together and you had to remember what happened last time. You know, and you guys work in a lot of animation, so my question is, I feel like there's still like not many parallels to this X-Men show to this day.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been four or five shows that we've had a feel for that have, you know, Batman was gorgeous.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Definitely.
You know, we lived, as we produced our show, we lived in envy of their budgets and their animation. And a lot of people worked on both shows. And so there was, it's a small community. There was like sibling rivalry going on there. So we respect what they did. They didn't have the continuity. And we were talking about it. It's weird. They had incredible variety in their villains, which Batman people get up excited about, because there's this rogues gallery of people, because the core good guys was basically Batman and Robin. And you got to know Batman in two or three episodes. How many more in-depth stories about his character are you going to have in 70 or 100 stories? It's going to be more about the villains. In our case, we had nine people to get to know, and get to know their friends and their lives and their families and their dark past secrets.
Histories, yeah.
Stuff. So that was that. From the writing standpoint, that was a bonanza for us, and we got the focus. So a lot of episodes, there wasn't really much of a villain. Sometimes it would be a spectacular villain. Sometimes it would be, who are the villains in the Nightcrawler episode? It's some locals with pitchforks.
Well, you had a lot of human beings as villains, and that itself is kind of, you know, revolutionary for a children's show. Like a political group of humans, you know, that's crazy.
Yeah. That was another thing. We made a conscious decision, and some of the book series of the books, there was a lot of just, which superhero can beat up the other superhero.
Right.
And we liked the character stuff better. And I found it far more interesting with watching the X-Men having to deal with people, with normal people, than deal with just in a battle royale with a bunch of supervillains. Now the battling was still important. As I say, it's like guns in a Western. You want a certain amount of spectacle, but to me the cool stories were the X-Men dealing with human beings and dealing with trying to figure out how they fit in.
How they fit in society and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a real conscious choice among the writers that was the gold mine. To dig out of.
Yeah, and that was great. I want to move on to the fan questions, and then we'll get back to talking about the book before we wrap up here.
Sure.
Not too many fan questions, but they're kind of funny.
We've maybe answered a couple of them already, but shout out to Dave that asked about the side characters. He was also interested in knowing if there was anything that the writing team wanted to do that Fox wouldn't allow, if it ever swung in that direction.
Yeah.
You're getting an exclusive here.
It's in the book, but
if you don't want to tell us, we could just get.
No, it's cool. But we wrote out the second season. If you remember the end of the first season, Scott
and
Gene say they're going to get married. He proposes, and she says yes. And we're going to start out the second season with their wedding. Yeah. We played out the second season, Mark and I, with Jean ending up 7 months pregnant with a mutant child.
Wow.
Double mutant.
Oh, my God.
And,
Jesus.
And so, unfortunately, that got, a lot of our core people who we trusted looked at that and said, wait a minute. Do you not remember what it was to be a 12-year-old boy? Do you want Jean going around 7-8 months pregnant in spandex fighting superheroes? This is just a little too weird for audience. So that's why Sinister was added at the end of episode 13 in the first season, was so that there was a way to get rid of the wedding. Because we'd written the wedding, we'd written the proposal, we wanted to have a wedding, and so we thought, wait a minute, if they can't have a kid, let's have them think they had a wedding, and it's a plot by somebody who'd do. And so we thought of Sinister. So that's how all that evolved. But we have documents places that have laid out season two with pregnant Jean.
Oh my God, that's awesome. That's a shame that did not happen. stories like that just make me, like, I've always dreamed of an HBO X-Men show. And it could be animated too. It doesn't have to be live action. It's like there's so much like missed opportunity with I don't know. Okay, whatever. Next question.
Also, we had a question, which kind of relates, actually. We had a question from John, wondering if you had the chance to write or co-write a new X-Men project.
Oh, yeah.
If, from your perspective, you would prefer it to be a movie or a TV series or, one of these, Netflix or HBO-style shows. What would be your preferred venue?
Oh, wow.
Cool question, because we are addicted to these.
Yeah.
It's like that episode HBO FX show.
Yeah, so are we.
Yeah, I know that.
it's like a novel. That's the perfect length. A movie is like a short story worth of writing. But those 10-hour things are just perfect.
Yeah.
Then the question becomes, if that's what you're going to do, the question becomes, is it animated or live action? And I'm torn.
Yeah, me too.
I kind of think, especially with a little bit bigger budget, animation would be cooler.
Yes.
And what our friend, there's a TV critic, Brian Lowry, from Daily Variety, and he's on CNN now, who was like the number one animated television critic on the planet. And he did an interview for the book, and it's his opinion that superhero comic stuff works just inherently works better in animation than it does in live action. And he couldn't quite walk. It's just that it just works better.
Now, having said that, I ripped through the whole season of Legion.
Yeah, so did we.
Mm-hmm.
Remarkable what TV can do these days. I mean, remarkable. And so whichever way it would serve it.
We take either one.
We started watching Legion, and that's and as I was watching it, I was like, I just, this is so good, but it's not like the main X-Men characters. I just want to watch a show about the X-Men that's real serious. And I said, I'm going to watch the X-Men cartoon, and then that's what made me start doing the podcast with Sonya.
Nice to hear. Oh my gosh.
It's like Legion's great and it's very adult and it is what it is and I love it, but the X-Men is still almost like the pure unadulterated, sweet candy center of all the characters you know and love and all the situations, and it's still as close as you get to like the perfect X-Men live act, well, not live, but act, you know, animated experience. I think, you know, and this is no way to slight the movies, but I think it's like superior to the movies because you guys were able to go into more depth and cover more ground and
right, like you were saying, the novelization versus right. like a short story. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. We have one more fan question. This is from Matt. It's kind of a sillier question. He wanted you to reflect on the failure of the short-lived X-Men Pride of the X-Men show.
Uh-huh.
Because I remember you were talking before about the bad voice acting you got back initially.
Yeah.
I just recently rewatched this thing myself, and that voice acting is ridiculous and hilarious. And, you know, it's kind of like a, you know, compared to what you guys did, it's like a joke.
So, what, you don't like Australian Wolverine? Come on.
I mean, I actually kind of do in a perverse way, but...
Well, just so you know, we know, obviously we know about that. Yeah. Luckily, they had people at Fox. I mean, interestingly, a lot of the same creative people, there's an object lesson there.
Yep.
A lot of the same creative people involved in our show were involved in that. Margaret Lesh was there, got it made because she was working for Marvel. Will Mineo and Larry Houston worked on it as far as designers went.
Yeah.
But the horrible thing was there were executives at what was then New World Marvel Productions. And, I mean, there were creative voices that overrode them. They all knew what was wrong. Was going wrong with the story and going wrong with the voices and going wrong with a lot of, you know, but they didn't have the leverage.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's like we owe Pride of the X-Men. They
yep.
had all been through that and
yeah.
they all
yeah.
despaired at this missed chance. They all thought it's over. There will never be another time chance to do the X-Men. We ruined it.
Yeah. I mean, not to diss it too much. I mean, it looked great. You know, it was really cool
yeah.
looking. It had a great style.
Yeah. Yeah, but they understood what was wrong creatively, the story and with the voice direction, all that stuff. I mean, they understood what was happening, but they didn't have the power, the mm-hmm. you know, the business people or the marketing people, you know. I mean, and absolutely
was in a position to understand back then.
Yeah, 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 it was because I mean, Crocodile Dundee and 1 and 2 had been huge internet. That's why Wolverine was
straight. That's literally why.
That's so
funny. Now you know.
Those kind of decisions get made in Hollywood every day.
Yeah.
And you just need 2 or 3 of those.
Well, it was foreshadowing to Hugh Jackman in a weird way.
Yeah. That's funny. Yeah.
But and to their never ending credit, when X-Men the Animated Series opportunity came up, Will and Larry and Margaret dug their heels in and they said, we've been through this once and we know what doesn't work.
Right.
So mm-hmm. we are not going to let that happen again. And I know, stone cold fact, each of them at various times had to sort of put the career on the line and say, no, I will not stay if this gets changed, or no, you will have to remove me if you want to do XYZ. And it came down to those kinds of matches and they all held their ground.
Well,
and that's what,
you know, thank God for all you guys.
Yeah, again, worth it.
All right, so we have 2 last questions. They're about you guys, pointing forward a little bit. Before we get to them, I just want to thank you again so much for your time. This has been so much fun.
Thank you.
So the first question is, you guys are very active on social media, both with your website, xmentass.com, please go visit it, and your Twitter handle, @xmentass. What's it been like to connect with fans in a way you really couldn't have, you know, when the show was on the air? I mean, like we kind of discussed before, the internet is now a thing. You know, what's that been like?
Couldn't have imagined it. Honestly, could not have imagined it. And we had the sort of, it happened in a sort of funny way with me kind of poking at Eric to sort of start looking down memory lane here. And it was a year ago May that we got on X-Men TAS, the website, and also on Twitter. And that also happened to be the weekend that the movie X-Men Apocalypse was coming out.
Oh, wow.
And
oh, my God.
So within 24 hours, because neither one of us had been on Twitter, it's within 24 hours, we learned that the folks at Screen Junkies had done a trailer, an Honest Trailers. They do
hilarious. Yes, I saw it. I saw the one you're talking about, yeah.
Kiss on the lips to our dear show. I thought that was...
Yes.
It can be very... They can be very on target.
They
can be tough. But so not knowing anything, I reached out to Andy Signor, because that was whose name was on it. I said, is this really you? Because this is really good. And we really thank you. And he wrote back saying, is this really you? You know, they said, okay, this was Friday.
Friday, and on Tuesday we did an hour live stream with them. You know, so boom, 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 boom. You know, within less than a week of going online with Twitter and with our website, we're talking to the Screen Junkies people and getting streamed to hundreds of thousands of homes. So it was seeing people at cons.
Yeah. That's been new to us too.
You know, we'll meet people and we'll introduce ourselves, and if we're really lucky, X-Men was the show for them when they were 8 or 10. And that's very satisfying. We had the same thing. I mean, we're fans. When I remember the moment in September 1966 when I was a little kid, and there's some weird new show that came on with people in a spaceship, and in a space, the Final Frontier, and I didn't know what it was, but it's been 51 years, and I could remember every emotion of watching that first episode. So it's something we get the fan experience. We get how culture can just stay with you like your favorite song forever.
And I want to put this out there. 1992, sort of just by the process of elimination, Eric had his hands on every script and got every storyboard for the show and was responsible for, keeping all those pieces moving and, the memos, the notes. And by default, we put them in boxes and we put them in the space above our garage. And a few years back, it's like, well, we have this documentation.
Wow.
We have this here in our garage. We have this.
So she made me do something.
So does that lead into my next question? It's the 25th anniversary of the television show's premiere, and we've hinted at it, but you are writing a book now. So,
drum roll.
Yeah. So we want to know everything about this book. What the impetus was. When it's going to come out, where people can get it. How many copies we should buy.
Yeah, right.
Well, the funny thing is, Eric was talking about Star Trek for him as a kid, and I grew up in Texas, and boy, try being a girl geek in Texas back a few decades ago. That was even rougher. And Star Trek was my thing, and so when he and I were each in California and met each other, it's like, fellow Star Trek fan? Oh my goodness! So we both know very deeply what fandom means, and one of the first books you had as a fan and one of the first books I had as a fan was The Making of Star Trek. It was, that was one of the few things you could find that would let you see behind the curtain back then, because again, there wasn't the internet, there wasn't access, so that was like a thing as a fan that I really appreciated.
Yeah.
And then looking at the calendar and realizing that this anniversary is coming up and that there is no network support in place, there is no studio support in place, this just sort of became, well, golly, Eric, what do you say?
There were three or four publishers that really got the fact that it would be popular, and publishing is not easy these days. But,
right.
They got the fact that this would sell enough. And the one that we really liked best, it's a smaller, more independent, pop culture-focused place called Jacobs Brown Media. Mm. And they're here in San Diego, the home of Comic-Con. Yeah. They're in San Diego out here. And they have, a bunch of Star Trek books out. They just had a bunch of Lost in Space books out. They get popular culture, and they were the nicest folks, and so we went with them. And it's coming out. It'll be published this fall. We don't know exactly when. We'd hoped by September, but it could be as early November, certainly before Christmas. And we're going to start going to cons to support it. And I'm not sure how close we'll get to Brooklyn, but
just give us a little preview, maybe a half chapter in September, and if it's ready by January, we'll be ready.
Used to have a kind of working title, like, The Making of X-Men, the Animated Series.
Okay, wait. Another drum roll. He's about to reveal to you now the name.
The actual registered title that they've agreed to put. And so the title of the book is previously on X-Men.
Oh my, that's perfect.
That's amazing.
Oh my god.
Thank you for that reaction. What,
was that did the Cyclops guy Norm Spencer, is he the one who did that voice, or am I just making that up?
We think so.
We are trying to verify
We're checking that out. I don't know that for a stone cold fact.
Yeah.
Could have to ask him, but
we believe so. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was great too. Oh my god.
Any other details you guys want to share about the book or the show, or did we miss anything important?
Yeah, the book will be available like where normal books are, at bookstores, at comic stores, on Amazon. What the pattern that Jacobs Brown has been doing, which is kind of cool, which I appreciate. Obviously, as soon as Amazon gets hold of it, it gets discounted a bit. And so why would you buy it from Jacobs Brown website? Which you can buy all the books on the website if you can buy it cheaper on Amazon. What happens is if you buy it through the Jacobs Brown website, you'll get an autographed copy.
Oh my god!
Oh, awesome!
All right, so we'll be doing.
And what we're going to do is we're going to try to go to like a con a month for as long as
folks are interested.
As long as
you hear that, folks, you better be interested.
and set up signing tables, and so then it could be a more personal, signature. And I'm trying. The people we were talking to right now are Wizard World. We have 17 cons nationwide. One of them's in Philadelphia, right, like today. And so that's not quite Brooklyn, but it's close.
But they approached us and were great for that, about maybe joining them for various cons around the country. So this is a very homegrown affair. It's Eric and me.
Yeah.
This is the two of us trying to figure this out. So.
Well, I mean, like I said, it sounds so wonderful. We're definitely getting the book. We're going to talk about the book again when it officially gets released. We'll be following you on Twitter at XMenCast for those updates. And I just, I guess we should end it right here. I just can't thank you enough for
your contribution to modern entertainment.
Yeah, that. for helping us with our modest little podcast that is growing every week, thanks to you guys and helping promote it. We really love the show. I mean, that's, we're not doing this for any other reason than that we just enormously love the show. We love talking about it. We love, speculating on it. I personally love watching it with fresh eyes and, thinking about it on maybe a way too deep of a level.
But maybe not.
Maybe not, yeah. No, we've been having really a lot of fun with it. So thank you guys so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's been really interesting and a lot of fun to meet you guys.
Us too, Sonia. Thank you.
Yeah. You got a lot of love and support out here, so I just want to let you know. Can't wait for that book. So
thank you. Really thank you for that.
Yeah. Well, keep in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, that's all we got for today. So any last words, Sonia?
No, that's it. Thanks so much.
All right. Eric and Julia, any last words?
Just look for Previously on X-Men coming to a
Bookstore or anywhere this fall.
Yeah, somewhere this fall.
All right. We will. Eric and Julia Leewald, thank you so much. Best episode ever.
Thank you.
Okay.